looking at each other for more than an hour, and still no one could agree on how to react to the Soviet seizure of Nueva Venezuela. The president, puffing fitfully on a Havana cigar, finally rapped his knuckles on the top of his desk. "Gentlemen," he called out loudly, "arguments and recriminations are of no use now. We must decide on a course of action." Hernandez eyed the president through the haze of smoke from his own cigarette. A small man, soft and overweight. He enjoyed the good life that Hernandez had made possible for him. His face was bland and bloated. The man was weak. He always had been weak. And he always tried to cover up his weakness by demanding some form of action. "What action can we take?" shouted the Minister of Trade. "The Russians have troops up there, soldiers armed with guns." "We have troops," said the defense minister, "and we have rockets to carry them to Nueva Venezuela, too, don't we, Rafael?" Hernandez took the ivory cigarette holder from his lips before replying, "The Soviets might shoot down our rockets with the lasers they have in their satellites." "They wouldn't dare. That would be an act of war." Trying to keep himself from sneering at the former general, Hernandez said, "Would we declare war on the Soviet Union?" The defense minister turned toward the president, who still stood behind his huge, curved desk. "That is out of the question," the president said, shaking his head hard enough to make his jowls quiver. "Out of the question."
"Then what can we do?"
"We can send Moscow a formal protest," said the foreign minister, "and ask for an emergency session of the General Assembly to consider this matter. After all, that is Venezuelan national territory they have invaded. It is just the same as if they had landed an army on our own soil." "We must not allow our emotions to blind us to the facts," Hernandez countered. "The Soviets are not invading our country. They are searching the space station for the pirates who have been stealing their ore shipments."
"Why did they pick Nueva Venezuela?" demanded the Minister of Trade.
"Why not attack the Indian space station or one of the Japanese?"
"Because they suspect the American Randolph to be the leader of the pirates," Hernandez said.
"How could they believe that?"
"Because it is true."
"Nonsense! Impossible! Why would the Yankee billionaire stoop to such a thing?"
The others began to chime in, and the room filled with a dozen separate, clamoring voices once more. The president waved his hands and banged on the desktop again in vain. But then the phone on his desk buzzed softly, and every voice instantly went quiet. In the sudden stillness, the president picked up the handpiece.
"Yes?"
The others stared at him, trying to decipher what he was hearing from the expression on his face.
"Very well," said the president. "Send him in."
Hernandez turned to the leather-covered door. It was swung open by a tall, stern-faced military policeman in a polished steel helmet and spotless uniform. He held the door wide, and a small, wiry Japanese, dressed in baggy blue coveralls, stepped into the office. He was young, but his face looked haggard, strained. Still, there was a crackle of energy about him, an air of determined purposefulness. He walked quickly across the smoke-filled room to the president's desk. There, he bowed from the waist, arms clamped to his sides.
"I am Nobuhiko Yamagata, Senor Presidente. I thank you most humbly for granting me this opportunity to speak with you."
Hernandez was surprised at the quality of the man's Spanish.
"Senor Yamagata," responded the president, "I understand that you were aboard Nueva Venezuela when the Soviet troops seized it, and that you captured one of the Russian shuttles and rescued several of our citizens."
Nobo dipped his head in a brief bow of acknowledgement.
"I did not act alone. I was helped by a team of my countrymen."
"You stole a Russian ship?"
gasped the Minister of Trade. "And captured 8 Soviet soldiers. They are in custody at the Astro Launching Center."
Nobo reached inside his coveralls and pulled out a Russian machine pistol. A murmur of shocked surprise wafted through the room. He placed the gun carefully on the president's desk. It looked grim and deadly. "We are trying to decide what must be done," the president said, almost in a whisper.
"The Russians will kill all those whom they believe oppose them. They have already killed 12 unarmed astronauts, several of whom were native citizens of Venezuela."
"What?"
"My duty," Nobo went on, ignoring their frightened, questioning faces, "is to return to Nueva Venezuela and try to help rescue the others from the Soviet troops."
"We have prohibited all space launchings," Hernandez said.
"Precisely why I am here," Nobo countered. "That prohibition must be lifted, or many more citizens of Venezuela and other countries will be slaughtered by the Russians."
I find that difficult to accept, said Hernandez. The young Japanese turned to face him directly.
Sir, your daughter is there. Her life is in as much danger as the life of Dan Randolph.
Hernandez felt his knees buckle. My Lucita?
Yes, said Nobuhiko. If we do not act swiftly, she will be killed along with all the others.
Chapter 38. Zachary Freiberg's face looked drawn and grim in the small screen. He's aged since he's come to Astro, Dan thought. Then, correcting himself, no, he's matured. The scientist was in his office in Caracas. Dan was still at the communications console in the space factory. His legs unconsciously wrapped around the pedestal of his chair to keep him anchored in the zero gravity. The Russians were jamming all radio frequencies, but Dan could talk to his astral headquarters by laser, linked by a pencil-thin beam of light as long as the factory was above Caracas's horizon.
They're on a high-energy burn, Freiberg was saying. It'll be a week before they reach the asteroid.
They've got to be stopped, Dan insisted.
How, for God's sake, Freiberg snapped. The Venezuelan government has forbidden all launches. Rumors are flying around here that if we try to launch anyway, the goddamned Russians will shoot us down with the lasers from their anti-missile satellites.
Dan glanced at the clock digits ticking off in the lower right corner of the screen. Only a few more seconds before the factory's orbit carried it out of range of Caracas.
Even if we could launch a team after them, Freiberg was saying, they'd have to go at such high G's that they'd all have hernias or hemorrhoids by the time they caught up with the Russians.
You've got to do something, Zach. It's up to you. I'm depending on you. The whole country's depending on you. That fucking piece of rock is going to wipe out a hell of a lot of the Middle West. Millions could be killed.
I know. The computer projections, then do something. Get on the horn with President Scanwell and make her see that she's got to act.
I'll try, Freiberg promised. I'll try my best. The picture in the display screen suddenly wavered wildly, then broke up. The screen went blank. Dan leaned back in his seat, exhausted, drained physically and emotionally. In the faint reflection of the darkened display screen, he saw his own face, haggard, hollow-eyed, unshaved, his hair matted and tangled. He suddenly realized that Lucita was gone. He was alone in the cramped little cubicle of the communications center. Before he could think of what to do, the door swung open and she entered, stepping carefully in her Velcro slippers, carrying a small tray laden with plastic containers. I could not find much in the galley, she said, only some soup and something that was labeled soy burgers, whatever they are. He smiled weakly at her.
I don't feel hungry.
You will eat, Lucita said, fastening the tray onto the console desktop in front of him. To keep up your strength, you must eat. He took the cover off a plastic bowl. The hot soup hung in a perfect weightless sphere, surrounded by a faint mist of steam. The aroma made Dan suddenly ravenous. He jammed the cover back onto the bowl and put its spout to his lips. The soup felt burning hot and invigorating. For several minutes he ate and drank, saying nothing. Finally, I've done everything I can, he said to Lucita. She nodded. There's only one other thing I can think of, he added.
What is that?
We can put you back into a suit and send you back to Nueva Venezuela. Moloch doesn't want to hurt you. You could get out of this.
Not without you, Lucita said.
I could surrender to him, Dan pointed out. He won't kill me. He'd rather put me on trial in Moscow, put on a big show. He made himself grin at her. It would be a big help to have you testify in my defense. You could be my character witness and tell them all what a great guy I am. She did not smile back.
He will kill you as soon as he can.
Before Dan could say anything more, someone tapped at the door.
What is it? Dan called out.
The door opened wide enough for a man to stick his head in. It was Coptins, the scarecrow lean Latvian with the wild hair. His long, lantern-jawed face was somber.
They are coming, Coptins reported. The shuttle that was at the loading dock has disconnected and is coasting this way.
Dan pushed himself to his feet, automatically letting his slippers grip the Velcro carpeting.
It's filled with their troops, no doubt.
No doubt, Coptins agreed.
With Lucita trailing behind him, Dan trudged down the long tubular corridor that led to the factory's main airlock. They must have left some troops aboard the station, he mused aloud, to keep it in their grip. Coptins nodded vigorously enough to make his whole body bounce.